Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Art Connects podcast with me, Nick Horston from Steamco. We're going to go to the very heart of creativity with a world authority on the subject, but first some feedback from a primary teacher, Ed Finch, on the last episode.
Kirsty Williams, what an amazing lady. What a bold set of decisions to do that to the curriculum. I mean, almost turning it upside down, and you can't fool yourself that that's going to be popular with everyone. So now, making that a bold move, you've got to give kudos to that. It'll be interesting to see how that's supported and resourced, because it will be a big challenge. Like she says, especially for colleagues who trained under the national curriculum. That's probably most of them now, isn't it? I think there's a lot to take for England as well. If we look at Mr. Corbyn had been taking away the SATs, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. But what do you put in its place? Well, look at how they did that wide and that deep consultation, making sure they went right into the heart of the communities to find out how this was going to work. Imagine if you did that, looking at end of key stage assessment. We could end up with something that's world-beating instead of the excuse we got now. So, brilliant podcast. Love listening to it. Thanks a lot. Looking forward to the next one.
Ed Finch there, a fantastic, totally inspiring and committed primary teacher, a good friend of Steamco, talking about the podcast we did with Kirsty Williams, the Welsh Education Minister, who was about to roll out a curriculum with creativity at its very heart. Creativity is the real subject that's driving us here at Steamco. We advocate for creativity. We believe we should put creativity first in our schools, work and lives. We see art as being the combination of creativity, tools and people, where tools are sometimes technology, because technology is only something that was invented after you were born, after all. So it's with great pleasure that I had the chance to record a podcast with an academic, an incredibly globally respected academic. In his TED talk, Ken Robinson talks about academics walking around with these big heads full of information and knowledge. I think you'll find from this podcast that Professor Bill Lucas is one of the most engaging, one of the most grounded, one of the most inspiring people around on this subject, and I hope you'll enjoy this. In fact, I hope you'll enjoy it so much that you'll go and rank this podcast. We need to get the word out on this. This is really important stuff. To go to wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to this podcast, put a comment in. If you want to let us know, send us a little sound file, we'll stick it on the next podcast. Anyway, over to the session I recorded with Professor Bill Lucas down at the University of Winchester. The audio is not brilliant. I had a new microphone that wasn't working terribly well, and the acoustics were a bit hard, but the message is in the music of what Bill has to say here. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so welcome to whichever episode this is of the Art Connects 19 podcast, because I really am struggling to keep up here, but I just get more and more excited with this. I've just driven through howling wind and rain down the motorway to Winchester with somebody who I'm just full of respect for. And he's going to kick me under the table when I tell him that these podcasts are the A to Z of the Art Off podcast. And I'm going to call this podcast the Art of Academia, because I'm here with Professor Bill Lucas at the University of Winchester. Bill, you didn't kick me under the table, so thank you for that. Hello, and thank you for joining the hot seat for these podcasts. Academia, you are a professor, we're here at a university, but what little I know about you, I know that you've not been in this world forever. Give us a bit of background.
No, you're right. No, I didn't kick you under the table, Nick, and I'm not intending to, however much you provoke me. And I am an applied academic, so that means I really enjoy wrestling with research questions, but I don't like to do it on my own or even in the imaginary ivory tower. I like to do it with communities of people, and the people I connect to most and understand most and care about most are those working in schools. Not just schools, I do a lot of work with credit practitioners and also in health, but when it comes to schools, that really, really, really matters to me. And so understanding not just how I might like to change the world, but what research says, what the evidence suggests about how we might go about doing that is pretty important. So for the last, actually, I think we're in our 11th year now here at Winchester. 11 years ago, Guy Claxton and I set up the Centre for Real World Learning. The clue is in the title, and that's what we've been doing. Guy's now moved on because he's just a little older than me, and so he's now emeritus of this fine university. And the university's also heavily into teacher training. So we were originally King Alfred's College, very much a teacher training Foundation. Interestingly, we're not anything to do with the education department, because another sense I have is that it's easier to be radical when you're connected to but not part of a system. So I'm just as interested in playing with my friends today, for example, in psychology, who are interested in the neuroscience of creativity, all the things that are happening in our brains when we're thinking creative thoughts and doing creative things. And we're sitting here in the business school, so really interested in practical and vocational learning and employability. So that's me. I'm not at all a conventional academic. In fact, at one stage in my life, I was deputy head of a large secondary school.
And then hang on. Academic who's taught in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
The convenient meaning that's going along.
Oh, sorry, Nick. So do I have to kick you under the table now? And I thought actually that I was going to be a teacher or even head teacher for life. My dad was a head. So I grew up with a dad who was a workaholic and loved talking about and caring about kids. Actually, the only thing I knew when I came down from university, apart from being broke, was that the only career I would not touch with a barge pole was teaching. And being broke, I saw an advert. In fact, I saw an advert in The Guardian for a summer job teaching English to European kids at Sevenoaks School, and took it. It was better than stacking shelves. And within a nanosecond, I was hooked. I thought, this is amazing. This is what I want to do with my life. But the first 10 years or so in schools at the chalk face were and are, I think, the grounding for everything I think about teaching now. Then I took a sideways tack, and a bit like you, actually, I was a social entrepreneur, so I started to...
Oh, thank you, I'll have that.
You'll have that, will you?
I'll have that title.
Okay, so I'll stroke you under the, as it were, under the table. So I founded an organisation called Learning Through Landscapes, which is all about, kind of in a way, it's kind of the stuff you do. So it was about big science outdoors. It was about understanding...
Don't you dare put me in a science box.
I'm not understanding the arts outdoors.
Oh, well, there we go.
I don't want to put anybody in any box.
No, of course.
In fact, that was part of what I was trying to do, is to take the box off the school or the classroom walls and enable and encourage and support kids and teachers to get outside, and not just to be working with teachers, but to be working with other experts. I mean, you go into a school and you're not wearing your teacher head. You're wearing your love of experiment and arts and science, dare I suggest, because quite a lot of what you do is sciencey or steamy. And then I had a really interesting policy and research job at the Campaign for Learning. So this was, we've now got to 1997. Historians of English will know that that's when David Blunkett published what I think is probably the single most lyrical piece of writing about education, called The Learning Age. And it was a dream of how schools could connect with families, of how schools were a seamless beginning on a lifetime of learning. They were kind of a point on the journey. Now, some of that has happened, but not all of it. And I think I'm just finishing reading a book, which you may have read, called The 100-Year Life, which is a fascinating reminder that all the kids being born now, the likelihood is they'll live to be 100 years or more. So this old idea of three score years and 10, and, you know, we go to school for a bit, and then we, if we choose to, go to college or university, so there's a learning bit, and then we work for a bit, and then if we're still alive, we have a bit of a retirement, and then we die. You know, that bit of a retirement thing needs to happen during our working life. So I'm imagining that what I did accidentally, i.e. three quite serious career shifts, is going to be the norm. And I suspect that some people will take a break and they'll go back to university, or they'll go and do some community work. So again, you know, what you've done, coming from a more obviously commercial world into an obviously not commercial world.
Well, it depends which way you look at education at the moment, but yeah, fair enough.
Well, Nick is smiling at this stage, gentle listeners, because he's also in need of resource. So yeah, that's a long ramble to your question, but I'm absolutely not a typical academic. I'm proud not to be, but I'm absolutely interested in rigorous research as well.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, we need to prove things work. I mean, the word outcomes has become very loaded, and Ofsted are almost dropping it. Well, I don't want a penny of my tax being spent on education if we're not looking at outcomes. Okay, we might need to change the word. going back to where you came into this, you didn't want to be a teacher and then suddenly you found yourself becoming a teacher. I am absolutely blown away by teaching and teachers and the profession and the craft and the experience. Mm. I was in a school today in Oxfordshire, in a very new secondary school. I was in a room with 240 year eight children, 38% special needs, from a very challenged setting, all over the place. My goodness, it was hard work, but how fulfilling when 30 or 40 come up at the end and somebody writes you a little note and thanks you. And it's just incredible. And I've got this agenda. I was chatting to Richard Gerver recently in another podcast. It's the most incredible experience, yet so denigrated. And I didn't say this to Richard, but I meant to. I work with a boss, and frankly, I had a work with a guy once, CEO of a company. And I'll say this, one of the biggest arses I've ever known. And he had this phrase, which he used to love saying, and I almost felt it was his. I hadn't realized it's quite generic. Those who can't teach, and I know you've heard it 1,000 times. My God, that guy wouldn't stand 10 minutes with those kids. And Lem Cisse said in a speech I saw a few years ago, he said, we couldn't do what you do every day, the visiting poets, the steam crazy guys with rockets. And yesterday I was in a school in Derby, and the kids were just absolutely on fire. And the teacher went, goodness, we've got to have them back later on. What a shame that this is such an unrepresented profession or unrespected. And there's a job to be done to celebrate education. I spoke at an event last week called Celebrating Education. And I think one of the things we've got to do, I said to Richard Gerver, we have got to do something to get word out, because it seems to be spun against, because another 0.5% salary increase is going to sort of drain GDP. I mean, what are your thoughts about education and why it is so dumbed down? I mean, you've written some amazing books. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? And what creativity itself, you're a professor of creativity, we'll come back to that, but creativity is a dirty word in many places, in many contexts. Why is that? Why does education get such a bum deal?
Okay, too many questions for me to field there.
Yeah, no, go on. Yeah, but
so the kind of the question balls are flying around. I'm just going to kind of, I feel like I'm chasing the, what's the little ball in the Quidditch game in Harry Potter, the snitch, and it's just out of my...
Well, I'm just going to sit back for an hour now. You've
got my reach. I think that there is, the problem, I think it's new actually, that not everybody has a fine word to say about teachers. But actually, I don't think it's any worse now than it ever has been. I think it's ignorant and ill-informed. And you only have to, as you said yourself, spend a small amount of time with teachers to realise what an extraordinary job they do. So I just don't see your world, mainly because I go into schools probably as many as 3 or 4 a week. And I see, and often I'm speaking at conferences, so I'll be down in Cardiff tomorrow speaking at a conference for hundreds of Welsh secondary schools that have been embracing our five-dimensional model of creativity.
Well, there are 10 podcasts in Wales alone, aren't there? The work that's going on in Wales.
We'll come back to Wales. I've got a lot of time for what's happening in Wales at the moment. But my point was going to be that I tend to interact with people who are passionate about some bit of the job called teaching. So I think, if you think about teaching in the abstract, and I'm going to run a similar argument for creativity in the abstract, it doesn't work. But if you think about a particular child, or something that a teacher cares about a lot, like history or science or outdoor education or canoeing, it doesn't matter what it is, then you get through to the core of the relationship. Because all teaching's really about relationships, isn't it? And so whether you're going in as you've done today and you're dealing with a whole year group, you've still got to very quickly in that situation, at least hold back the forces and form a relationship with the people whose eyes you're catching in the front row. So it's about relationships, and it's about doing things that gradually you didn't know what you necessarily you're going to be interested in, but you get the bug, you get interested in it, and then somebody helps you to be able to push yourself a bit more than you thought you were going to be, and suddenly you're loving it, and suddenly it's becoming a bit tricky, and then you're still loving it because you're learning how to keep going when stuff gets tricky. So I think I'm deeply optimistic about the teaching profession. I think there's a lot of crud going on at the moment, mainly financially led, but I don't think that the world out there, and I think there's some great advocates, by the way, for teaching at the moment. I think that, for example, Jeff Barton at Askell is doing an absolutely terrific job in banging the table in a thoughtful way and writing elegantly and regularly and lyrically, actually, to use that word again, about the role of heads and teachers, and indeed the arts.
I mean, Jeff's an absolute superstar. He spoke for us. In fact, you made the introduction. He spoke for us at our King's Cross event last year and did a fantastically eloquent piece, 2 or 3 minutes, but nailed it. The argument for arts in education, the funding cuts, social mobility, independent sector. Well, this isn't class war. Incredible. Yeah. Great job.
And your other ball was about...
Actually, before you go on, another person who I think is a massive advocate, although we haven't heard much from them since a big flurry last summer, when she guest-edited Women's Hour, and I think you were on that show, Charlotte Church.
Yeah, I was going to see her tomorrow, but in fact, I'm going to talk to her next week. I'm actively involved in helping her create this amazing school.
So that's ongoing, that's happening.
Yeah, it's happening. Oh, she's making fantastic progress there. And it's a joy to have met somebody on Woman's Hour. I actually dialed into
as
that.
As a bloke.
I'd like to recall that last remark for the Me Too generation.
We won't be editing that out, Bill. I told you we'd press start and that's it, I'm afraid.
No, but what the listeners didn't know was that I was actually with my family on the Isle of Wight on a very dodgy Skype line. I'm dialing into Woman's Hour, and it was an extremely impressive discussion by very passionate individuals. Back to creativity. I think, again, the problem with creativity is that it's an abstract noun, and people will kind of go tick if they tend to have a prejudice for it or against it. Just like maths, you know, can be, it's too big a thing. People will just admit to being no good at it and move on. And some either like it or don't like it. It's surrounded by misconceptions. So the myth number one that you can only be creative if you kind of, this is for the guys, have a ponytail and work in Adland or you're an artist, simply not true. I mean, creativity infects every single aspect of our life, whether we're talking about science or geography or being a good parent or... Discovering something for yourself as you go out walking, that is about creativity. Within that general frame of creativity, I think myth number two, that we don't actually know what it is. Well, it is complicated. So, no, I can't write you a single sentence. Actually, I could write you a single sentence about it, and it would have words like value and originality and imagination and curiosity in it. But the fact that we can't all agree or land on exactly the same definition says, oh, that's interesting. It's probably a really worthwhile concept. I couldn't define love. I couldn't define science. I couldn't define the arts, actually, not in a reductionist sentence, because it's a rich complex with many disciplines and many historical lines of thinking. So there's something about understanding it. But when you've opened it up, and here's what I try and do, and this brings maybe our conversation between schools and creativity together. You've got to go into schools with something that's a sort of at a middle level. At this stage, listeners, what I'm doing is using my hands like that to kind of indicate that at the top level, now pointing at the ceiling, that you get abstract. But somewhere in the middle, if you start talking about being inquisitive or about being imaginative or about working with others in complex situations or the craft of creativity, being disciplined and really learning how to write something or to experiment something or to play something more creatively. And always it involves persisting and persevering and quite often challenging people's assumptions, because by definition, you may not be Einstein, you won't be Einstein, but you will have what Anna Kraft potentially in you, what Anna Kraft calls little c creativity. And that's what I'm about. I'm about helping anybody I meet to have a good idea when they need one, to know how to sift through the false news that we're surrounded by, so to use their critical thinking faculties, to know how to have the emotional intelligence to read the kids or adults around them so that the thing that they're doing as a group can actually fly, to know how to practice. I mean, this is something, you know, again, another myth that you're kind of born creative and you just sail through life if you are creative.
It's quite easy, isn't it? You don't have to work at it. I mean,
which is, you know, yeah. completely wrong. So I hope that's just kind of a short riff on, we need to get below the surface of the abstraction. We need to talk in a straightforward and engaging way to teachers and parents as well, and kids, about what it means to be creative.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, we rebranded Steam Co. 4 or 5 years ago to call it Steam Co. from something else.
What was it before?
it was the Little House of Fairy Tales. So the House of Fairy Tales is a project run by Gavin Turk and his wife, an amazing creative thing they do at festivals. And they let us use the name Little House of Fairy Tales, like TED, TEDx. And 3 years in, we'd been on BBC Breakfast and Al Jazeera and Wired and all the, lots of, and they said, well, actually, we quite like our name back, which is fair enough, which is good. So I went with the Steam thing. So I'd seen Steam Coming. And I'll be honest with you, it was tapping into the zeitgeist of Steam Coming. But also, there's a bit of Eisenbach Kingdom Manel in it as well, the Steam Company. And it does make me smile when people say, oh, Steam Company, Nick from Steam Company. We're not Steam Company, we're actually registered as Steam Collaboration CIC, Community Interest Company, because it's all those lovely co-words. And you know what? I don't give a damn for acronyms, which is why I tease you when you say, oh, science or art or whatever. I don't give a damn for acronyms. It's about creativity. Mm. And in education, it's about the teaching of creativity, creative subjects, the arts, whatever, or DT, whatever you want to call them, and teaching creatively. So there's a pedagogy aspect to it as well.
Yeah, there is.
As well as creativity, as you've just so perfectly described, in life.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people say, we don't need to be teaching creativity, even if you can, and we don't believe you can, but even if you could and you can, we don't need to teach it to people because they don't all need to be creatives. We haven't got jobs for these people. So these are life skills.
Yeah.
These are survival skills. These are, you're on minimum basic income in 30 years' time. How are you going to spend it this week? How are you going to juggle that? And how are you actually going to use your entrepreneurial skills to go and do something over there or to facilitate this? These are lives. So when Ken Robinson does a TED talk and say, my contention is that creativity is now as important as literacy, everybody throws their hands in the air and says, oh my goodness, how dare you say that? Because what they think you're doing is bringing literacy down to their perception of creativity. And in fact, what I believe Ken was saying was, we need to bring it up to a level par. And in fact, I've had teachers say to me, do you know what? It's more important. And for those people, because they're in special needs situations, there are kids who will never be able to read. So in fact, to them, surviving in this world without being able to read or have special needs is creative challenge number one.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's in a sense an evolutionary skill, which we've not necessarily, except by accident and where you have brilliant schools, we've not actively nurtured enough in schools, certainly not in secondary schools. I mean, something happens in secondary schools called decisions at 16 and a massive investment in testing at 16 and the concurrent specialisation that is deeply unhelpful, over-specialisation. So there's a notion out there in the world of work of the T-shaped person. And the T-shaped person has the long arm of the T is the deep knowledge of something or things. And we need deep knowledge and deep passionate knowledge. But then we need other, what I would describe as dispositions or capabilities, which is the top bit of the T. And taken together, a lot of those are what I think of as creativity. So exactly the kind of life skill bit you're talking about. I didn't say this earlier on, but I feel very strongly, I'm just writing something for a centre in Australia on this at the moment. I think that 21st century skills is a really unhelpful meme. And it looks lazy, evangelical, and it's patently ridiculous if we still haven't figured out what they are. And if we can describe them now in 2019, it is nonsensical to assume that they would necessarily be the same in 2050 and 2099. It's just nonsense. It's a kind of brand that got ahead of itself, kind of nested in the millennium bug malaise in the 90s. And so I'm on a mission at the moment to be more precise about what the important learning life skills are, what my colleague and friend Guy Claxton and I would call the epistemic skills. So the things that help you get better at knowing about knowing and learning about learning and thinking about thinking. So that ability just to stand back a little bit, almost to be the coach on your own shoulder and look at a situation as you head into it thinking, last time I did this, I just kept going and it wasn't helpful at all. Maybe I should stop and listen. Or last time I got stuck here, I got really aerated and I wanted to thump somebody. You know what, this time, as I feel that coming, I'm just going to get up and walk around the room, or I'm just going to say, do you mind if I have a one-minute breather? Or I'm going to have a stop and think, close my eyes, and try and recollect what it was I did last time that worked when I got into a kind of head-on situation like this. So you bet they're life skills. And I've just finished some work for the Victorian Curriculum Assessment Authority in Melbourne and have been looking at the impact of embedding critical and creative thinking on student achievement. Interestingly, there is some, and it's positive. With creativity, it's a relatively small effect, and with critical thinking, it's a relatively large effect. And that means that the argument that some run, who are critical of this, which is that you can't do this because it distracts you from helping kids get better results, is not just silly, it's factually incorrect. So there's an argument, I think, and there's a really important debate to be had, that if you, and everything you do has to be done carefully, thoughtfully, rigorously, if you do these things and plan these things carefully, and care and discipline and craft sit well with creativity, then these things can fly. And the danger is that poor images of creativity are sometimes received by people who've had, unfortunately, ill-conceived experiences of their creativity being developed. And it turns out it was a not well thought through project on something that was remarkably similar to what they did last year, as opposed to a deeply creative, engagingly authentic set of questions which so light their fire, and with so much appropriate support that whatever skill level they're at, including those with the special needs that you've described, they can still contribute in a meaningful and creative way. So yeah, they're life skills. Interestingly, we've got for the first time, if you think back, you've mentioned Ken Robinson. I'm doing some work for the Durham Commission on Creativity in Education at the moment, and have been reviewing...
Was that the Nicholas Sirota project?
Yeah. Right. I was with him yesterday. Yeah. And it's a terrific project.
I know.
And so I've been reviewing all the major inquiries and commissions into the role of creativity. So you go right back to the Plowden report, and then you can track some key interventions, and the NATSE report in 1999... The QCA work in the first decade, introducing personal learning and thinking skills, and there have been a number of others. But I was looking back over, asking myself the question, so if we had really impressive reports, why? How come we haven't, you know, acted upon them? And in almost every case, there is a reason. Either it was particularly associated with the political philosophy, or just as it got published, a key minister or a key government moved on to another kind of place, or just as it was ready to go, the money was running out, or part of it was associated with a line of argument for which there actually isn't very good evidence. So I think the latest iteration, the Durham Commission, we're going to do our damnedest to make sure that we, in a sense, critique kindly the past to make sure we keep what's good and have a theory of change that is more compelling. And the key thing here that has changed is that in 2000, employers were not on board. Today, employers, large, medium, and small, are on board. They don't have to be persuaded that...
Well, it's interesting because Lord Baker and the Edge Foundation came out recently and said, we need to get rid of the GCSEs. A member of the Royal Family called me in a corner one day at an event and said, you know what, GCSEs are a load of nonsense, but don't tell anybody I told you. I mean, goodness me.
Well, GCSE...
Who do we have to convince?
You're heading off into another interesting alley here.
Well, that's where you were a moment ago.
Yeah,
it
was. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the control exercise by 16-plus examining, as now implemented in Progress 8 and Attainment 8, has an unintended, very unfortunate consequence, and it squeezes many of the subjects that we care about passionately.
And narrowing everything down.
Narrows everything down. And the bogus notion of some being academic and some not. There was a ludicrous moment when music was not considered to be an academic subject. Now, you only have to study the medieval trivium and quadrivium to discover that music was actually one of seven, you know, the kind of forerunner of the Attainment 8. So think of the medieval Progress 7, music was in there. So, you know, just silly and historically lazy. So let's not get distracted onto exams, although the whole issue of creativity and tracking progress is something I care about.
What I do want to come back to, though, is a word you said two or three times that really rang a bell, the word change.
Yeah.
You've got some great ideas, you've done some great work, looking back. Is this massive system change that we could just never accommodate in this country? Because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, every time I ring you up and say, oh, can you come and speak at this event? So I'm in Australia, so I'm in the Middle East. Yeah, why can't we have some of this in our country? You're such a brilliant export. Can we import some of you? In fact, Brexit might not be such a bad thing if it makes it harder to export, Bill Lucas.
Well, that's
what's going on there? What's
very kind of you. And I work with individual schools and with clusters of schools extensively in England. I used to work very closely with government. At the moment, I'm not, although I'm very heartened by some things that the current Secretary of State for Education is saying. So I was at a conference, also speaking when Damien Hines announced creativity or framed creativity as one of five pillars of character. And that's the first time I've heard that noun, creativity, from the Secretary of State's lips, and it was said carefully, thoughtfully, and in a wholly appropriate way. I just want it to be embedded in the formal curriculum part of life. So if we look around the United Kingdom, historically I've done a lot of work in Scotland, which has trailblazed with their Scottish Curriculum for Excellence. As I said earlier on, I'll be down in Cardiff tomorrow, and the Welsh curriculum change has been significant. And now, just like Australia, they've taken much of the language from Australia and some of the thinking from the OECD, and they now put creative thinking squarely into their curriculum. And they're in the and they've managed to start with support from Arts Council Wales at secondary level, which I think is really, really smart. And they're looking at how that can now spread out into the vocational pathway, and already it's in the primary.
And is that happening nationwide in Australia then? Because I know they're
nationwide. Yes, it is. Australia, one of their two most distinctive, what they call general capabilities, are respectively critical and creative thinking and social and emotional learning.
So I wasn't sure that when you go to Australia, it might just be working with a bunch of clusters like you do over here.
No,
some great maths.
No, when I go to Australia, I'm able to.
That's a national level.
My favourite school in the world is Rudie Hill High School, which happens to be a.
That you wrote about that in Creative Thinking, didn't you?
It just happens to be in this book that I just happen to be holding in my hand,
which we just happen to now be
teaching creative thinking.
That's a great book.
And I just happen to be going from this podcast in a few minutes to an event here at the University of Winchester on the power of play and creativity in education. And one of the arguments we'll be running with one of my colleagues here, Alison James, is that we need more playful pedagogies at university level. And with another of my colleagues here, Paul Sowden, who brings a psychological and neuroscientific perspective, we'll be thinking about what's going on in the brain as you go for a walk and how that exercises your creativity. So, you know, you're right to be gently ribbing me, Nick, but the answer is you're only, despite my thought about the 100-year life, you know, I'm in my seventh decade and I just want to
really?
I'm 63.
Well, you look good in that. Bloody hell.
Thank you.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you, Nick. At this stage, Nick looks slightly shocked.
I'm going to let you off the hook in a moment. Another minute or so on this. So this whole journey for me personally was kicked off watching a TED Talk. We all know which one that was, and reading half a book. And that half a book was What's the Point of School by Guy Clapton, which I think is as valid a question now as it was then.
Absolutely. It's
and
brilliant.
Guy's been very generous. He's spoken at a number of events. He spoke at our launch at the Royal Institution, blah, blah, blah. And came to Liverpool actually 5 years ago. And I think one of my biggest frustrations in a way is I would so love to have engaged with Guy around the BLP stuff and weave some of that into our activities. Mm. And frankly, I'll be honest with you, I'm going to say this on the record now, Steamco is a bit of a bodge. It's a few rocket kits, a bit of stuff in a trailer. We need some rigor, we need some pedagogy in that. And that's what I'd like to come back to. Guy said something on the phone then that really touched me. He said that as parents, as teachers, as society, we have to help our young people understand what they want to be great at and help them follow that dream. Seth Godin then popped up with a quote, art is what we call it, I mean, what we do might connect us. So what we're doing with Steamco on this summer tour, the Art Connects thing, is connecting our kids with their art, whatever it is, whether it's coding, football, fashion, photography, whatever, and connecting communities with schools. And what we want to do is run events where parents, children, teachers, local business people stand up at mini TED Talk type events and talk about their dreams, their passions, their experiences. We've got, you probably saw that film, The Little Lad in Leeds, who got the train set. Him and his mum and his dad are going to say a few words at an event in Leeds. I think one of the biggest milestones that never happened in the world of education, bridging schools with their communities. The book that never was the multi-million bestseller that should have been is Educating Ruby, a book you wrote with Guy Claxton. I don't want you to plug teaching creative thinking. We've done that. We've done the academic stuff. What was amazing for me about Ruby, and I think it's as amazing as the book that's on the table here at the moment, that Richard Gerver book, Education Manifesto, which is groundbreaking, because that's about business and schools collaborating, which has to happen.
We've got 30 seconds, Nick.
Tell us about Educating Ruby and why you know why I think it's a very important book. Give us your pitch on that book and why we need to relaunch that book and get that into the hands of parents and teachers and children and business people across the country. Give us a 30-second plug for that book now, and what was behind it and the seven C's.
Well, the motivation for Ruby and her seven C's was a joint disenchantment with the status quo and a particular upset as we talked to friends of ours who had kids in the system. Many of them very bright kids, but not all, and many of them gone on to very prestigious universities, and they weren't happy. So it was driven from a kind of well-being perspective, if you like, okay. Sadness. And coupled with, we're privileged, as you've reminded me, to go around the place dealing with and meeting and learning from amazing educators. So we wanted to bottle that, but we wanted to make it accessible. Ruby is a gentle polemic. But it's a polemic starting from an individual who is called Ruby, who is, we imagine, to be Rita, as in educating Rita's fictional granddaughter. And she's in a school near you. And we want it to be uncomfortable. We want parents and teachers who read it to think, flippin' heck, I could do that. And what I'm doing is quite a gap away from what I'd like to be doing. How long can I live with myself and leave that gap? And to make it non-judgmental, so it's simply stories of people who are doing something close to this. And I think partly because it is a fictional conceit that there's this girl called Ruby, people identify with it. And whilst it's not made us a million, it's, I think, in its fourth or fifth edition. So, you know, it's doing okay. But anything that your millions of listeners, Nick, can do to boost
sales. Well, okay, so we're going to wrap up now. The Art of Academia. I'm just a dad, I'm going to give you my advice. When you see Charlotte Church next week, work out a plan to get that on Richard and Judy's Book of the Week, Costa Book of the Week, put some pictures in it and bring it to life. Bill Lucas, we've been asking people at the end of the podcast, if art is what we call it, when what we do might connect us, what is your art? What do you do that you think, whether at a personal or professional level, connects you?
I make music.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Let's do a podcast handshake on that and let's leave the readers hanging. Amazing. Thank you so much for your time and generosity.
Wow, what a fantastic chat. What a great guy Professor Bill Lucas is there. He's been a rock to us at Steamco. He spoke at a launch event we had in the Houses of Parliament for the Summer of Love Art. He's always there. He's a real carer. He's a sharer. He's a retweeter. If you get the chance to see him speak, either on an online Zoom thing or for real, then do seize it. It's absolutely wonderful. And be sure to read that book as well, Teaching Creative Thinking, a very practical hands-on guide, as well as some of the books that he's written with Professor Guy Claxton, things like Educating Ruby. Wonderful, wonderful books. One of our top five books. Look forward to seeing you, meeting you, being with you in the next podcast. But please remember, please like this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to it. Maybe pop a review in and feel free to email one to yourturn@steamco.org.uk. Do a little sound file, send it to yourturn@steamco.org.uk and we'll stick you in one of the podcasts coming up. Thanks very much for listening. Appreciate your support. It means so much.